You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump is calling for unity. So are President Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. But how can the nation come together after an election that pulled Americans apart? We'll talk about the psychology of reconciliation.
First, while the race for president dominated the news for most of Election Day, the races for the House of Representatives and Senate could have shifted the balance of power from the Republicans to the Democrats.
But as the results came in last night, it became clear that the GOP would maintain their hold on both branches of Congress. And while many incumbents held on to their seats, there will be new faces joining the governing bodies on Capitol Hill.
We'd like to hear from you about this. What was your reaction to the congressional elections? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Harry Enten joins us now. He's senior writer and political analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
My pleasure.
Before we dig into the congressional races, let's talk polling in general. Presidential race, a lot of Senate seats, including Wisconsin, discrepancies between the bulk of the polling and the outcome. I assume you and everybody at 538 and lots of other people are trying to suss that out. What kind of things are you looking at now?
Well, you know, I think there are a few things that need to be pointed out. It turns out that the national polls are going to be fairly accurate. Hillary Clinton is going to win the popular vote. Obviously, that doesn't get her to the White House, but the popular vote will be within a few percentage points of where the national polls put it. It was the state polls, however, that were way off, and specifically that they were off in a number of states that proved to be pivotal, such as Wisconsin, such as Michigan, and such as Pennsylvania. Turns out that in states in which there were large populations with white working class, that is, white voters without a college degree, the polls on average were well off about 4 or 5 percentage points, and that was enough to swing the election of Donald Trump.
So how do you correct for that next election cycle and tweak the formula so that the polls are more accurate next time?
Well, you know, that's a question, and I think oftentimes it's a little bit difficult to know how to do that exactly. I think we know that, you know, poll response rates have been down for a while. We haven't necessarily had huge errors, but I would point out in 2014 the polls were also off. It just so happened that Republicans were winning anyway, so I don't think very many people noticed it. But, you know, state polls can be off from time to time. They were off in 1980. And I think what we need to recognize as an industry, although I'm not actually a pollster, but what the polling industry needs to recognize is that the techniques that they are using right now, there's something clearly a little bit off on it. It's not as bad as, say, the UK general election was in 2015, but it's not good.
And you had written a piece just a week or so out. It was maybe even less than that. It was something along the lines of Donald Trump is just one common statistical error, basically. I don't remember the exact wording,
yeah,
away from winning. So it was not beyond the realm of possibility.
Yeah, you know, I think that there are a few things with that. Yes, absolutely. If you go back over time, someone who has a 3-point national lead with a week to go, I mean, usually that candidate wins, but it's far from guaranteed. I mean, George W. Bush was leading in the popular vote by 3 percentage points heading into the final week of the 2000 election, ended up losing that popular vote. Of course, he became the president because, like Donald Trump, he won the Electoral College without winning the popular vote. But if you go back over time, errors such as what we saw in the polls are not that uncommon. They are uncommon, but they're not that uncommon that we should be shocked. But I think what also helped in the sort of shockedness among at least certain voters or certain people is just the idea of Donald Trump actually winning. There's a difference between understanding that he can win and understanding there could be a polling error, and I don't think for a lot of people the two kind of mesh together. They understood it mathematically, even if they didn't understand it sort of substantively.
And Harry, I want to get to Congress, but first I do want to ask you, I mean, a lot of people watching this race, politicos and voters themselves, kind of live and die by the polls. You know, they get emotionally involved in one way or the other. They get scared. They freak out. I mean, make the case that we should still pay attention to polls, that polls still matter when clearly there are such holes in the framework sometimes.
Well, you know, I think the polls do have errors, and I think if you're going to pay attention to polls, you have to recognize that there are errors, so that if you look at our final forecast, for instance, I believe we had Hillary Clinton with, about a 71.6% chance of winning the Electoral College, something like that, some decimal point around 71. That means she was more likely to win than not, But I think people don't they expect too much from polling. Most polls are calling 1,000 people. And when you aggregate that together, you know, you can get pretty close to the final result. We knew that the race was going to be close in Pennsylvania. We knew that the race was going to be within 5 points in Michigan. But you're asking too much of polls then to say, okay, you need to be right on the button. And that's the reason why we hold elections with voters actually voting and not just taking polls.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about yesterday's elections and turning to Congress now. Here's a theme I saw, Harry. Democrats did kind of an old-timers campaign here in Wisconsin. Russ Feingold, former senator. Indiana, Evan Bay, former senator. Governor Ted Strickland in Ohio. Familiar household names. These are races that were Democrats to lose. They thought they could take a lot of seats there. They lost all three of those in what people are seeing as like an election where people wanted change, not these familiar faces.
Well, I think that there are a few things there. Number one, you know, in Wisconsin, the Republicans tried that in 2012 with Tommy Thompson, and it didn't work out either in that particular case. And I think in a change election, that's probably not the best thing that you want to be running. But I'm not sure at the end of the day that it mattered that Russ Feingold or Ted Strickland or Evan Bayh were formerly members of Congress or governors. What mattered at the end of the day was who won the presidential race in that state. If you look in every state in which Hillary Clinton won, the Democratic candidate for Senate won. In every state in which Donald Trump won, the Republican candidate for Senate won. It was, for the most part, straight-ticket voting. Now, there were some exceptions of where candidates might have run stronger or weaker than the presidential candidate of their party in that particular state. But it was mostly straight-ticket voting, and even in play, it didn't matter whether you distance yourself or hug Donald Trump, voters just voted down the line, Republican or Democrat.
And Harry, can you catch us up on the race, the Senate race in New Hampshire? What's going on there?
Well, that was actually one of the tightest races in the nation, and it also was one of the tightest races on the presidential level as well. Kelly Ayotte, the incumbent Republican senator, has in fact conceded that race to Democrat Maggie Hassan, the Democratic governor, the Secretary of State in that state. Has basically said that Hassan won by a little over 1,000 votes, which, although is very close, really can't be overcome in a recount. So the Democrats will pick up that seat, and it was a state that Hillary Clinton won by far less than a percentage point.
So that, if I'm doing my math right, adds up to two seats picked up by Democrats when you throw in Illinois, not the number they needed to make up.
No, when Donald Trump won the White House, they needed 5 seats, 4 if Hillary Clinton had won. So they, in fact, didn't come close at all. They were hoping, for instance, to win in a state like Wisconsin, which, for the most part, the polls did have Russ Feingold winning, even though they closed late. But the fact that Donald Trump won in that state and then won pretty much across the board in the key Senate races pretty much doomed Democratic chances for taking back the Senate.
What was the biggest surprise for you last night, Harry?
Well, I think the biggest surprise for me, in all honesty, was probably the state of Pennsylvania, insofar as it was long believed that the suburbs around Philadelphia would come out in droves for Hillary Clinton to allow her to be able to overcome what was supposedly and turned out to be strength for Donald Trump in some of the more rural areas as well as some of the older Rust Belt cities in Pennsylvania. And while they did give her good numbers, they were not any better than Barack Obama's numbers for the most part. And in doing so, Donald Trump did much better in other areas. And I think that's really the story, was in many places Hillary Clinton matched or slightly exceeded Barack Obama's numbers, but in many more places Donald Trump met or very much exceeded Mitt Romney's numbers.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Rob. I wanted to say, I'm really worried about the Congress because, sorry, I'm tired like everybody else. I would really love to see the Electoral College reformed by making it proportional, but with a proportional assignment of electors, but that's impossible with the Congress the way it is right now. And I feel that the Democratic vote was lower than expected, partly due to voter ID laws in a bunch of states and elimination of some early voting.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Harry, is that something that pollsters, analysts are going to be able to measure the impact of, as Sarah was saying, different kinds of voter ID laws or changes in early voting and removal of voting stations in some states? How do we suss that out?
Well, we'll essentially compare states by laws, and we'll have some time to do that as the days and weeks develop. I think that there are certainly some complaints that some voter ID laws in North Carolina, for instance, perhaps had a big impact in lowering the percent, the number of African Americans who turned out to vote there. We'll see about that when we look at the actual numbers. But again, I don't think that's the that's part of the story. There were just a bunch of different things that kind of added up together that allowed Donald Trump to be able to win.
Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. And we're talking with him right now about congressional victories and losses in yesterday's election and also the discrepancies between the polls and the results.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the makeup of the new Senate and the House? Did you think Democrats were going to be able to take it? Why do you think they fell short? What would you like to see out of Congress over the next few years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Harry Enten of 538.com, talking about the races throughout the country last night for Congress. Republicans prevailed last night, maintaining their hold on the Senate and the House. Here's current House Speaker Paul Ryan giving credit to President-elect Donald Trump for the victory.
Our House majority is bigger than expected. We won more seats than anyone expected. And much of that is thanks to Donald Trump. Donald Trump provided the kind of coattails that got a lot of people over the finish line so that we could maintain our strong House and Senate majorities.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the new look in Congress, the changes there, what you hope or fear from the Republican Congress with a Republican president. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Harry, we just heard there from Paul Ryan saying, hey, Trump's coattails helped us in the House. A lot of the talk leading up to the election was, is Donald Trump going to hurt Republicans in the House and the Senate, for that matter?
Look, the fact is that the House of Representatives, the way that the seats are designed, gives more control to rural areas and suburban areas and white areas. And that's the same reason that Donald Trump won in the Electoral College. Democratic strength is concentrated in the cities, which, while can help you run up the popular vote and win that, is not good for winning the Electoral College and is really not good for winning in the House of Representatives. So to me, it certainly suggests, looking at the results, that Donald Trump really didn't harm House Republicans at all.
And what is the takeaway, do you think, from that for, I guess, for Democrats who had big hopes going into this election, didn't see him pan out? What's the lesson?
Well, I think the lesson is you have to go back to 2006. That was when Democrats ran a strong campaign to take back the House of Representatives. They hadn't controlled the House since 1994, and what they did was they went into many areas that Donald Trump did very well in last night, rural areas, certainly ex-urban areas that are more conservative, and recruited candidates that matched that sort of ideology and were able to do well. And I think that's the lesson that you're going to have to take in for Democrats over the next 2 years. Remember, there's going to be a midterm in 2 years. And historically speaking, the party that's out of power does particularly well in midterms. We saw that both in 2010 and 2014. It's a real chance for Democrats to build back their bench, but they're going to have to recruit candidates who speak to the issues that are important to those constituents in those perhaps more suburban and more rural districts.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Superior. John, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what factor money played in certain elections. I know, like in Feingold's case, I saw the Republican ad against him many, many times, but I never saw any rebuttal ads from Feingold. So just a comment.
John, thanks for the call. A big money push for Johnson in the last couple of weeks of the campaign. It seems like the national groups were slower to respond for Feingold. Does a money gap like that make a difference, Harry?
Well, it can. You know, in lower ballot races, we're going to have to go back and look specifically at the gaps from state to state. I do know, for instance, another state where the money gap almost certainly made a difference was in Ohio, where Rob Portman jumped out to a huge lead over Ted Strickland, and Rob Portman raised more money than pretty much anybody else running for Congress this year. But, you know, we should keep in mind on the presidential level, Hillary Clinton raised a lot more money than Donald Trump and spent a lot more money, and it didn't matter one iota.
John, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Benjamin in Appleton. Benjamin, hi.
Hey, good evening.
What did you want to share?
Well, you know, I was listening to Harry just a little bit on my afternoon drive. I like what you said about the fact that there's another election in a couple of years. And the message I took from the contest last night was, if you look at the overall picture in the United States, there were a lot of states that were very close. And I felt like the people had the opportunity to take control back of their government. I think in with the congressional seat that went to the Republican Party, I think they're getting, the people are giving them a chance to make something happen. And if they don't do it in a couple of years, I think there'll be a flip. And I agree with you, Harry. I think you're right on the money with it.
All right, Benjamin, thanks a lot for your comments there. And, you know, speaking of making a change, getting stuff done, Harry, I'm curious what you think about the prospects for that happening. I mean, we've had President-elect Donald Trump not being wildly popular with all strands of the GOP, the establishment there, Paul Ryan, case in point. So, I mean, do you think this is going to be the kind of scenario where the people who have been dissenting within the Republican Party will fall into line behind Trump? Or do you think we're going to see sort of factions within the GOP that might make it difficult to get some things done?
Well, I think you'll probably see a little bit of both, right? And especially in the beginning, there's probably going to be more unity than factions within the Republican Party, because Donald Trump will get a honeymoon like most presidents do. He may still be disliked by more voters than liked, but he'll get a honeymoon period. And we do know that there's already going to be some infrastructure bill that's going to be put in front of the Congress. And even Nancy Pelosi on the Democratic side said that she's willing to work with Republicans to try and pass that. So I think at least initially they're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, in Washington, if you want a friend, you get a dog. And the fact is that it could be a very quick time before all of a sudden there are dissensions within the Republican ranks. But I think one thing that will allow sort of Donald Trump to sort of coalesce Republicans is the fact that he did so well in the election. And more than that, they're going to want a Supreme Court justice. There is an open seat on the Supreme Court, obviously, and Republicans are going to want to fill that with a conservative.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at last night's results in Congress and elsewhere. Back to our callers with Jim on the line in Appleton. Jim, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I'm a progressive. But I drove right through what now apparently is Trump country. And I could tell almost immediately the polls had to be wrong, just judging by the number of doubt signs I saw out in the countryside. I mean, it was at least 25-1, maybe 30-1, because if you saw one Trump sign, you saw five on the lawn. And I started talking to people when I go to the different stops, trying to find out who they were voting for. And it's like they just wouldn't admit they were going to vote for Trump, but you could see that they were going to. You say, well, who are you going to vote for? Well, I don't want to vote for Hillary because it's a crooked Hillary and the emails and Benghazi. And you could tell they had all the rhetoric down. But I said, so you're going to vote for Trump? No, I don't know if I'm going to vote or not.
Huh.
And then when I tell them that, well, then you're going to vote for somebody else. They're like, well, don't tell me who I can vote for.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. There's a lot there, Harry, but he brings up the whole shy Trump voter phenomenon that people are wondering about in the polls and are talking about maybe a little more now. People saying, I'm undecided, but maybe they're undecided leaning strongly toward Trump.
I think that there are a few things. Number one, we should point out that in some states, Hillary Clinton did better than her polling average, so it wasn't something that was uniform. But I should point out that, number two, there was something going on, Gary Johnson losing some votes in the final few weeks there, and Trump was rising at the same time. So it does seem like Trump was picking up some people who initially had said that they were undecided or going with a third-party candidate. And I will agree. I think that there was something missing in some of the polls. There was an underestimation, perhaps, of how well Trump was going to do among white voters without a college degree, and I think with white voters overall. But the fact is, if you look at the polls as well, I think that people didn't quite understand that as well, that Trump was not going to do as poorly as Mitt Romney did with, say, African Americans, which I think shocked a lot of people. But the polls had that. But the reason for the error, most of all, was probably because Trump overperformed with white voters. Why that was, we'll have to wait and see.
And Harry, what benchmarks are you looking for in terms of the transition to let us know that the tone, how things might go over the next, well, I guess for during the first few months of a Trump presidency?
Well, I think, you know, as I watched last night, I think that last night, at least Donald Trump said the right things to calm people down who thought that it was going to be, you know, Benghazi and we're throwing Hillary Clinton in jail. There was none of that. He acted, I think anyone who is rational could agree, in a manner that was presidential. And Hillary Clinton in her concession today acted in a way that recognized that. And Barack Obama, even despite hating Donald Trump, recognized that. And I think, you know, look, we have a system in which we elect presidents with the Electoral College, and Donald Trump got the majority of votes in that Electoral College. And we're going to give him time. That's what the American people do, and we'll see where things go. But there wasn't anything last night that suggested Trump was going to do something crazy. Perhaps it was during the campaign, but there's a difference between a candidate and then recognizing that you have the full weight and power of the office of the presidency behind you, of the most powerful country.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com, and he was with us there to talk about the outcomes in the race for Congress.
Think of the words that framed this election: bitter, tense, nasty, acrimonious. The list goes on. The election, in some cases, turned friends against one another, caused couples to retreat into silence. We've heard that from some of our callers. The American Psychological Association confirmed election stress disorder was a real thing.
Well, now that the election's over, how do we heal our relationships? How do we unify and move forward as a nation and with our family and our friends and our neighbors? And we want to hear from you on this. How are you moving on? Are you ready to move on, or is it too soon? Call us at 800-642-1234.
Clinical psychologist Janice Abrams-Spring says reconciliation sounds good, but it's not always possible, especially after what we just experienced. She's the author of How Can I Forgive You? The Courage to Forgive, the Freedom Not to. Janice, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, this was a divisive presidential election. I don't think there's a lot of argument there. We heard anecdotes of people not talking to each other, in some cases even married couples, a spike in therapy sessions over election fears. How can we heal now that we're a day past the actual election day?
There's this term called homophily, which is basically says that often married couples, partners, have the same worldview, and people do tend to bond and associate with people who are like-minded. So there may be an exaggeration of the number of couples who are at each other's throats about this election. It may be more that married couples are more similar in their political views, those who tend to bond together. Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't incredibly rattled. And within families, there are tremendous differences that people feel vehemently about. And that's going to be incredibly divisive as we head into Thanksgiving and the Thanksgiving feast. Family members are going to have to negotiate these differences among each other and with the friends and families and everyone in their world.
We heard from some callers. I remember a caller on this show, a woman who called and shared with us that she and her husband hadn't spoken to each other since one of the presidential debates, and there they are in the same house, not speaking at all. And we also received this recorded comment from a sophomore at UW Oshkosh whose political views differ from his girlfriend's, and they're trying not to damage the relationship. And here's that clip.
I identify as a Republican, but my girlfriend identifies as a Democrat. It has created some tense moments in this election cycle, but I think it has created more thought-provoking conversations than it has tense moments. Something that I have found to work is that each of us finds some common ground, and we just talk about something that we each believe in, and we don't try to change what the other person believes.
It's an interesting tack. So they try to find common ground and talk through it, have some interesting conversations. Do you recommend that, Janice, or do you think at this point the wounds are too tender and it's better to maybe talk around it?
Yeah, well, it sounds from this interview that they're trying to respect each other's differences. And again, I think that if you are you go into it, you know, with a curiosity, that's helpful. Help me to understand the reasonableness of your position. You know, if you go in with, and that's really sincere, I don't know that many of us are really capable of that because we have such strong opinions, and of course we think we're right and you're wrong. But if you go in with that attitude, is I really want to understand why you voted for this candidate, to treat you as a reasonable, intelligent human being who makes good decisions, and you're genuinely curious about that. You know, if you go in and it's going to be a battle and you just want to prove I'm right and you're stupid, well, things aren't going to go well.
Yeah, sit us down at the Thanksgiving table, and we know Uncle So-and-so is on the opposite side. How do we get from, goading each other, dropping talking points of our side against their talking points? Is it better to just not talk about that stuff at all, or is it good to try to open that door and have a positive as possible dialogue?
Yeah, there's actually a very funny Saturday Night Live skit on this, where family sits down and it's with the turkey and everyone is looking forward to seeing each other, and they start talking about political views and they just tear at each other's throats, and in between Adele starts to sing, and every time there's this argument Adele's voice comes on and sort of drowns everybody else out. I think that it's a lot to manage, and I really think that before you sit down at the table, you know probably who's going to prick you and who you'll get along with. And I think it's helpful to have a mental plan before you go in. What is this Thanksgiving meal going to be about for you? So when you leave the table, how is it going to feel? What is it? What is going to be your input? How are you going to make that happen? And I think having that kind of intention before you set foot in the door and appreciate who's going to rattle you and how you might respond to that can go a long way in controlling those emotions. Otherwise, it's just going to be a mess.
We're talking with clinical psychologist Janice Abrams-Spring about how we can unify as a nation in our community and also just with our friends, our family, our neighbors. How can we move forward now that the presidential election is behind us? And Janice, what about the victors in this match? If you're someone who was backing a candidate who won, be it at the presidential level or something further down the ticket, what's a good approach to dealing with, you know, the people who might not be feeling so happy?
You're asking about people who have voted for those who have been defeated?
Who have won, yeah, who have, well...
To not gloat and...
Right, getting at issues of gloating. What if you want to walk in and go, I won! Your person lost. I mean, what should you do?
Right. Again, you know, there's politics and then there's family. And I think people have to know what the intention is of the evening. Do you want to feel victorious? Do you want to win the argument? Do you want to have a nice evening? Do you want to demonstrate tolerance among to your children? I think people have to have in mind before they enter the door, what is it that they want this evening to look like? I remember on a very personal level, I was thinking about this interview, and I remember just a couple of weeks ago was the Jewish holidays. And at the end of Yom Kippur, there's also often something called a break fast, where you go over to families or you go over to a friend's house and you eat to break the fast. The fast starts the night before and lasts the day of Yom Kippur. So I'm a Reformed Jew, and I go to my friend's house, and this woman comes up to me, and she said, "How was your fast?" And I said, "Well, actually, I don't fast." And she looked at me, and she said, "Well, you can't be a good Jew if you don't fast." So I had to decide how I wanted to respond to that at my friend's house. This is a typical kind of thing that could happen in with the politics. Mm-hmm. Somebody makes some kind of blanket statement that is so really obnoxious and, you know, and so hard-edged. And I looked at her, I said, "Well, you know, we all have different ways of being Jewish, and I do consider myself a good Jew, and I don't fast." But I was struck by her stridency, and I think this is the kind of thing that's going to happen with the politics. So people are going to come in with very rigid ideas, very black and white. You know, A is good, B is bad. You voted for A, you're a jerk. I vote for B, I'm right. You're a racist, you're a woman hater. I mean, there are all kinds of labels that people can throw around, and it's going to lead to fireworks. It's going to rapid escalation and a divisiveness that is very hard often then to heal. And again, I think people have to really think through what when they walk out of that Thanksgiving meal, what is it that they want to accomplish?
Let's bring on a caller now. Donna is with us in Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that in order for this country to heal, it's going to have to be up to us, the people. It's going to have to be like a grassroots movement. We're going to have to reach across to our neighbor and figure out why did they vote the way they voted? How is it that they're hurting? Because the politicians in Washington just don't have the capacity to do this. So it has to start with us. And we have to learn to meet people part of the way and just to compromise. When did compromise become such a horrible thing? Thank you, and I really enjoy your show.
Donna, thanks for the compliment, and thanks for the call. So people taking the initiative themselves to maybe, we hear about, Janice, this big sort in the country where more and more we, and you alluded to this earlier, we're only in contact with people with similar views to ourselves. She's saying, let's take the step, painful as it might be, to reach across that.
Yes, I mean, I think that if you can invite somebody, help me to understand your point of view, and you really are doing that with an open heart. You are a reasonable, intelligent human being, and you have voted differently than I have. Help me to understand what your thinking is. Educate me. Help me to understand what your thinking is. If you can really do that with an open heart, you might learn something. If you're just going to go in to prove how stupid the other is or how ill-informed, then, you know, then you're in for a battle. And I don't know what it's worth.
We're talking with clinical psychologist Janice Abrams-Spring about how we can unify as a nation, move forward now that the presidential election is behind us. She counsels people in particular on issues of trust and forgiveness. She's the author of How Can I Forgive You? The Courage to Forgive, The Freedom Not To.
You can join the conversation right now at 800-642-1234. Are you at odds with someone about the outcome of the presidential election? Did you feel tension during this election when you brought up politics around the dinner table? And maybe you avoided talking about the election altogether. What are your plans about dealing all this, especially now that we have Thanksgiving coming up and post-election season to look at? Add your story to our discussion. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation with psychologist Janice Abrams-Spring. She's talking about how to reconcile with family and friends if you had a falling out with someone over this divisive election, and how should the nation go about healing as a whole.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page, maybe with your stories or your questions about a divide and trying to bridge it, maybe with friends and family. We'll go back to our callers. Amy is with us in Toma. Amy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Amy?
Well, I'm a Clinton supporter, and I also have a lot of friends and family on Facebook. I do not personally put my political views out there, but I know a lot of people, a lot of my friends and family do. And in this election, I've had a couple people that I've unfollowed because every day the postings were so nasty. Today there were many of them, and very nasty, saying things such as, you know, God has prevailed, and Clinton and your supporters are going to go to hell, and you're losers. And I don't even want to be friends with these people anymore. And some of them are actually family members. Some of them are close friends. I've been friends with for years. And I'm just so angry and disappointed in how they're goading and treating. And I'm not even sure what I want to do anymore, if I want to be their friend. I'm not even talking Facebook, but just their comments.
Amy, thanks a lot for that call. And Janice, I want to get to the last part of your book title, The Courage to Forgive, The Freedom Not To. How do we know when it's time to cut our losses, that someone has crossed a line that maybe you shouldn't forgive?
Yeah. Well, people tend to confuse forgiveness with what I call reconciliation. And by reconciliation, I mean what type of relationship you're going to have with this person, the degree to which you're going to be involved with them. So when you confuse the forgiveness with the reconciliation, what it means is if you have views that so offend me, I may decide that I can't have a relationship with you, I cut off from you. That's perfectly fine. You may decide to make a thoughtful decision about that, that given your stridency about that, your position, really, we're just so different. You offend me, and there is no relationship here. I don't even want to see you or talk to you or Facebook you or any of this. But another way of thinking about it is that often we have relationships with people that serve us in many different ways, especially with family members, where we don't necessarily agree with their views, and we don't forgive their positions. But we make a decision that's a self-interested decision, that we are going to get along for the sake of the relationship. It has some benefit for us. You know, it could be that you're with a mother or a father or a sister or a brother where it doesn't feel good to you to be cut off from this person because of a political view. In the end, someone's getting punished here, and it's often you, because it doesn't make you feel good about yourself when you can't talk to family members. And so separating out these concepts that you condemn a behavior, but you make a decision to have a certain degree of a relationship. It may be that you are, you know, you take interest in each other on the holidays, you get along in front of the kids, but it's not a kiss and make up, and it's not my views are your views.
Well, Amy, I hope that helps. I appreciate you calling and sharing your thoughts with us. And we're going to go next to Matt in Decorah, Iowa. Matt, hi.
Hi. I've just been hearing a lot of people talk about, you know, the divide or what made people vote for Trump. And I voted for Trump. And what made me do that was just because of my lifestyle of things that happened. And, for example, my son who has, at his worst, 2,000 seizures a day. And we lost our doctor when Obamacare kicked in. My wife also lost her insurance because of it. And I had a $50 an hour job that I lost. And because of that, I now have to work over 100 hours a week. I used to be in the medical business, but now I have to work 100 hours a week as a cook just to be able to pay for everything that I have to pay for. And so that's the reason why I voted for Trump, is because I didn't hear any change about the affordable health care or the things that actually affected me. And I think there's a lot more people like me that used to have really good jobs, but now, I mean, I can show my printout clips. I work over 100 hours a week, and I don't get overtime because I work too many jobs, but I have to work that just to support my family. And I voted for Trump just because I believe that that's going to make a change and be able to help me and help my family.
Matt, thank you so much for calling. And I'm sorry to hear about how things have gotten harder for you. And I think Matt is doing sort of one of the building blocks of what you're talking there, Janice, is that he's sharing information. And it sounds like if you're someone who didn't vote for Trump, who might be angry about that, it can help to hear what someone else is doing. Walk a little bit in their shoes if you can and try to listen. What do you think?
Well, exactly. You know, that, you know, if you're just going to go in and you want to prove your superiority or your superior reasoning or whatever, you're in for a battle. But if you go in to try to understand the reasonableness and the humanity of the other person, help me to understand why you voted for X. What is your thinking? What is your story? You know, you open yourself up to learn about that other person's reasonableness. And it's not a battle. It's two human beings talking about their life experiences.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Amanda is with us in Appleton. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I'm a teacher at the high school level at a public school, and a majority of my students are white. And a lot of them, I found out today, were Trump supporters. I did know of a handful of them throughout the election process that were Trump supporters. And most of the time, their comments to me, just because they assumed I was voting for Hillary because I'm a teacher, most of their comments were filled with some of that hateful rhetoric and just shouting out things. And they definitely weren't in the frame of mind to be receptive. Today, when I came into school, I was kind of afraid of what I was walking into. So I rehearsed a response for them before I got to school, and it was something to the effect of, this has been one of the most divisive elections in our nation's history, and regardless of what the outcome was, we all need to be respectful to one another, and in this classroom, you will be respectful, and that is the expectation here. And to ensure that this happens, we need to avoid talking about politics. And the students were not big fans of my response to that. They wanted to jab, they wanted to poke, they wanted to prod at me. And I knew that there were a few students in the classroom that would make me feel very uncomfortable, so I had to just keep shutting it down. But what I'm afraid of is that they are misinterpreting my lack of desire to discuss politics with disapproving of their viewpoint.
Amanda, thanks a lot for sharing that story, and we'll give you the last word. Janice, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. I don't know that I have a last word.
Oh, I'm sorry. For Amanda, sorry, we're out of time, Janice, but thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That's Janice Abrams-Spring. She's a clinical psychologist and author of How Can I Forgive You? The Courage to Forgive, the Freedom Not To, talking about reconciliation after a contentious election time. You can share your thoughts still and your stories over at the Central Time Facebook page.